Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We'll be in-depth on what President Trump said and what he meant. But first to the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome, Ken. How are you?
Let me say good morning, Carrie.
Busy week, lots to talk about. If you have questions...
Isn't it a remarkable weekend, wasn't it?
It is. If you have questions for Ken, we'll open the phone lines here, and you can also tweet them in. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Susan Page, I think, got a sense of some of what you were saying was remarkable, Ken, in her analysis of the inaugural speech. She said, a speech that was shorter in length, darker in tone, and blunter in language than any inaugural address in modern times. I'm interested in what you heard.
I think that's a fair analysis. I agree with it. I think that when you think of inaugural addresses, it's a time to break free from what is usually a rancorous campaign. You try to unite both sides of it, and there was no attempt at all by President Trump to unite the two warring factions. It was basically, instead of saying, this is all about us, I thought the inaugural address was more about us versus them, and them is the media, and them is the people who lost out, and not just the Democrats. I think he talked about Republicans, too, representing the old order, the old guard, and this new force, and Donald Trump is certainly a new force, will be leading this new charge.
So this is interesting. You're saying his audience were also the members of Congress that were sitting there and listening to him frame where his presidency is going to go. And there was maybe a bit of a warning in that frame.
Absolutely. And of course, we're not even talking about the 60 or so House Democrats who didn't show up, which is kind of unusual. But given the rancor and the bad feelings, maybe it's understandable. But even those who were there, you looked at the faces of the Democrats who were there, even some Republicans. It was not all thumbs up. You know, Bob Dole gave his famous thumbs up when he was approached by President Trump when Trump was finishing his remarks. But not every Republican felt that way, and certainly Democrats didn't either.
I want to play a bit of that speech, and I think this may be some of what you and Susan Page and others are reacting to when you talk about kind of the darkness of the tone. Let's listen.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first. Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs.
I think this is what you meant, Ken, when you said it's us against them. It's a real inward-looking kind of message, isn't it?
And not only that, there were other things he said when he talked about the crime and the decay in the inner cities and the jobs being stolen and things like that. It just seemed to be a very bleak portrayal of what the country is. And usually when you have an inaugural address, things are great. It's a new day. The sun is coming out. The birds are chirping. Everything will be fine. And even if things won't be fine, there's an optimism. I did not feel an optimistic view. I felt an angry view. And look, clearly a lot of people are angry over the last 8 years, and Donald Trump's election was hopefully an antidote to that. But I didn't expect that tone to exist. It's one thing to hear it in the campaign. It's another thing to hear it in an inaugural address.
Well, why is that, Cam? Why is it one thing for the campaign and the other in the inaugural?
Well, yeah, I mean, because, I mean, just look at history. I mean, you think of Well, I mean, there's so many things to talk about, but you talk about how ugly and bitter and personal 1980 was with Reagan and Carter, but you think of that Reagan's optimism in the 81 inaugural address. You think of the anger between Clinton and Bush in 1992, and yet Clinton was offering a new beginning, a fresh start in 1993. So we always, look, there's always been a difference between governing and campaigning. Not every president does it successfully, but I've never seen it seem like a president seems to be very willing to keep campaigning. And that's what I kind of saw in not only in the inaugural address, but Saturday's address to the folks at the CIA.
Right.
And then, of course, his press secretaries in the days following that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute, Ken. What I've wondered about this is whether the Trump team and the president himself really care how widely supported their policies are. I mean, he's got that core of super loyal people, and it just doesn't sound like he cares whether a majority of the country really embraces his vision. I know that makes it hard to get stuff done on Capitol Hill, or does it, if his super loyalists retain with him?
Well, I'm not convinced how much of the country doesn't support his new vision. I mean, given the fact that he was elected on issues like we were going to bring jobs back home, we will make America safe. Forget about the details on how to accomplish that. But if you want to create more jobs, you want to lower unemployment, you want to make America safe from terrorism and make the world safe as well. Well, I think the majority of the American people believe that. Whether it's a simplistic view of the world is another thing. But that these are Trump priorities, and Trump insists that's what he's going to be working on for the next 4 years, if not the next 8 years. And I think certainly the majority of the American people certainly supports that.
Here's your mystery newsmaker sound of the week. Let's listen.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
So who are those people and what are they talking about, Ken?
This is the Soviet Union in 1950. this is a startling appearance by Kellyanne Conway on Meet the Press on Sunday when Chuck Todd is talking about Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, when he said this was the most widely viewed inauguration in history. And, of course, there's absolutely no information, no facts to back that up. He said, well, this is probably not true. Sean Spicer said something not true. And Kellyanne Conway said, well, these are alternative facts. And, of course, that went viral, and it should go viral because it's just – I mean, how many times on your show am I going to say the word surreal? This was unbelievably surreal, and this is how the administration starts on day one, baiting the press, having a press secretary refusing to take questions, and a top counselor refusing to accept reality.
Well, except that, Ken, this doesn't look all that different to me, as we've just discussed, about what went on in the campaign. And his loyal followers did not care.
Yes, you're absolutely true. And everybody says, well, why is he still angry? Why he, the president, is still angry? Why is he still talking about all his grievances? Why is he still tweeting about, and attacking his opponents? And the answer is because it's worked so far. Now, people say, okay, well, now he's president. Now it should be different. He should get over this. But I guess the answer is why? Why should he get over it? Why should he? So obviously, I think, we keep talking. I keep reading in like the New York Times and elsewhere, and they say senior administration officials are aghast at what Donald Trump is doing. I'm not convinced they're aghast. I'm not convinced, the Reince Priebuses and the Steve Bannons and the Kellyanne Conways are aghast. I think they say, right on, Don.
I wondered about that because the Times story on the front page today is that even his topmost staffers are not happy with how rocky it was for the inaugural weekend. And then, the comments and all that, the drama that
says
followed.
Who? Says who?
Right. I don't know. And,
I read the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. Call here for you, Ken, from David in Minneapolis. Hey, David, your question for Ken.
Well, I would like to see the press, hear the press, stump him about the offshore purchases, his line of clothing, his stuff that he buys for his empire. He's buying everything offshore, but nobody holds him to account for that.
Okay, so, Ken, this is something that's going to be an ongoing issue because he's talking about buying and hiring American.
Look, you know, the fact is, during the campaign, he talked about bringing factories home, bringing jobs home, punishing factories and punishing industries that decide to leave the country, while at the same time knowing and acknowledging that all his clothing and everything is made overseas. I mean, the contradictions and the unreality of facts. The fact is that he says one thing and everybody goes along with it and says, yes, you're true. We got to do this. While what he's doing in his own life with his own companies, with his own products, just belies everything he's arguing for. So, you know, I think David makes a good point, a good question, but the press have been talking about this all along, and we see how much of an effect it's had.
You know, I thought John Harwood's, I think, news analysis in the Times over the weekend was interesting. He writes, the new president's agenda, like his campaign rhetoric, often looks backward. He aims to revive a coal industry sagging under the weight of competition from cheap natural gas and environmental concerns. That emphasis risks ceding jobs and market share in the growing renewable energy sector to China. And then Harwood goes on to say that in looking backward, Trump is ignoring demographic and global trends that are unstoppable. He's just announced today that he is going to be withdrawing from the TPP in the first 100 days. I think the implications of this may take a while to sink in, but it's an interesting thing to keep in mind as the first 100 days unroll here.
You know, that's absolutely true. And, you know, as you just said, the first 100 days, and I'm thinking, look what we've seen in the first 2 days.
I know.
The first 3 days. And we have, everybody loves to emulate, of course, the analysis after FDR's 100 days and all he accomplished, and then we'll compare it to other presidents. But this president, I mean, some of us in the media will say the president and this administration started off on the wrong foot, and others will say that the media got what it's deserved, that this is a new revolution taking over the country, and we just got to get used to it. And as Kellyanne Conway said to Chuck Todd later, said, look, you know, if you're going to keep calling Sean Spicer talking about falsehoods, we may have to revisit our entire relationship with the press.
She said rethink our relationship.
Rethink.
And what did you hear that as?
A threat, an absolute threat, saying that if you're going to do your own falsehoods, the old media, your own media falsehoods, we'll just have to go beyond the mainstream media or the lamestream media, as Sarah Palin used to say. And that's why he's tweeting all this stuff, because he says that it's unfiltered, it goes straight to the people, and it's an unvarnished truth, unlike what you see on the front page of the New York Times and other newspapers.
Ken, there's speculation that President Trump is going to move quickly to announce a Supreme Court nominee. I'm curious about whether you're picking up anything on how what kind of tactics Democrats may use on this nominee. I don't think they can stop it, can they? They would need some Republican votes to do that.
Yeah, but that's what we say. Remember when he first nominated Rex Tillerson, I think Tillerson will have his nomination for Secretary of State voted today in the Foreign Relations Committee and the full Senate. But when they first was announced, he said, well, you know, there's some Republicans who will stand up. And we saw over the weekend both John McCain and Lindsey Graham saying, I'm going to go for Tillerson. We'll see if Marco Rubio goes in turn. But here's the thing. When Harry Reid decided to stop the so-called Republican obstructionism during the Obama administration, and he got rid of the filibuster, Mitch McConnell said this is going to come back to bite the Democrats, and it has.
Right. Yeah.
It absolutely has. So there is no use. There's no ability of the Democrats to stop the cabinet choices as well as the Supreme Court choice with a filibuster.
They can ask tough questions. They can make the confirmation hearings uncomfortable. It looks like legislatively they can't stop the confirmation.
Well, look, as Al Franken said yesterday, wait a second, we had 11 hours of Benghazi, but we get one round of questions for Betsy DeVos. I mean, this is crazy, but that's the reality.
Ken, I'm curious about whether what you think President Obama is going to do, what his role will be after, besides writing his memoirs, which I'm sure he'll do. But what happens when he gets back from this vacation in Palm Springs? What do you think he'll do with the Democrats?
Well, that's a good question, because the Democrats are not united. We saw Michael Moore during the Women's March on Saturday saying that we've got to get rid of the old guard of the Democratic Party. We need new leadership.
Right.
Obama's talking about redistricting efforts and revising the redistricting process around the country. It sounds like minute stuff, but the Democrats have got to start somewhere. But he may be the only voice the Democrats have, because right now everybody seems to be talking at each other and pointing fingers.
And are you saying that, Ken, because while there are new leaders coming up in the Democratic, I think of someone like Kamala Harris from California.
Right. Cory Booker. Right.
Right. They are still rising and needing experience. Is that what you mean?
Well, they do, but plus the fact that if you look at the leadership in Congress, I mean, Nancy Pelosi has been there while the Democrats keep losing seats in the House. Chuck Schumer has just taken over from Harry Reid. We'll see how he does. But again, it's a Republican president, Republican Senate, Republican House, and they seem to have the wind at their sails for now. You know, we'll see, let alone 100 days from now, we'll see what happens next Monday when we talk again.
I'll see you next Monday, Ken. Thanks much.
Thanks, Carrie.